session number 30388, reel 8.
Well, I enjoyed my run. Another thing was, as I think I mentioned, we had on board a system called individual catering. That is to say, every mess was able to submit to the catering people a weekly list of the food they wanted within what was available, of course. And that was supplied from the shore. At Christmas time, it was customary to offer either a turkey or a ham to every mess. We had the choice. And our mess democratically elected in 1944 to have a ham. And some wag said, you know, when it comes to collect that ham, we'll send Izzy. So I said, look, I don't know anything about ham. I don't know a good ham from a bad one. I'm not an expert on ham. Oh, you'll get us a good one. We'll keel all you if you don't. You know, and the sort of threats. And they were pulling my leg about this for weeks on end, until the day came when all mess caterers were reported to the Liberty Board to collect their Christmas rations from the shore. I had my requisition form, a mess of 20 people. We were entitled to so much ham. So I was really quite worried. I mean, I'd eaten ham, but I knew nothing about it. And came to the victualling office in the dockyard, and when my turn came, there was a sour-looking chief petty officer dishing his stuff out. So I presented my ship, and I said, excuse me, chief. He said, I'm Jewish. I know nothing about ham. But if I don't look after my mess properly, they'll keelhaul me. He said, please give me a decent one. He said, and by the way, I have some duty frees, you know, shoved 40 cigarettes across. They cost 6 old pence for 20 big ones. He pocketed the cigarette and said a word. Disappeared, came back with his pinky parcel and said, here's your ham. Don't think you'll have any bother with that, son. And off I went back to the ship, and of course everybody on board was desperate to see what have they brought. I came down with the ham, and Nobby, our cook, was ready and waiting in the mess, and I brought this thing. And he said, oh, it looks quite a decent size. He said, you haven't done bad. He opened it up and he said, Christ, it's the biggest ham I've ever seen, sort of thing. It turned out it was about 50% more than we were entitled to. The guy must have taken real pity on me. Of course, I was the golden boy for at least a week after that. But this sort of thing happened, and it was quite, in a way, it was quite fun. Christmas was always a time when we were served our meal by the officers and chiefs and petty officers. It so happened we were due to sail on Christmas Eve, Christmas Day in the evening. So we had our Christmas dinner at lunchtime, served by everybody, and there was extra beer and all the rest of it. And you were allowed to let your hair down a bit. People pulled silly japes like sending things up the mast, signals up the mast, ladies' underwear, inflated condoms, sea boots, and so on. And you were allowed to take the odd liberty, like pouring a jug of water over a petty officer's head, or in one case, they poured some golden syrup over the coxswain's head. The coxswain had a skin for him. He was a very good cox, but he was a little bit unsteady on his feet at the time, and somebody poured half a tin of golden syrup down his back. And it took a long time to clear him up. But that evening when we left, going out through the boom, that ship was as steady as a rock, and so was he. He was a fabulous cox. He really was. He'd shaken all that off, and all that booze that had gone. He was doing his job, and he was doing it well. Now, I'll explain to you how we worked. We had, our workstation was in a small, very small cabin, about 25 feet inside what's known as the forecastle. You know, the ship has a lower level at the rear end and then the funnel, and then you've got the superstructure. Well, we were just about 25 foot at the lowest level, inside the superstructure. as it's known, the break of the forecastle, where the two, you know, the lower and higher part meet. And when you came in through the flak curtains there, there was a heads on the left, toilet area. Next to that was our small cabin, which was full of gear. It encompassed the ship's broadcasting system or tannoy system or whatever it was. There were loads of batteries on charge. I never knew what for. There was a tiny desk on which the helicraft set stood and took up most of the room. And it we had a telephone on there as well. And next to it, a voice pipe. And the telephone and voice pipe enable us to communicate with the bridge if needed. There was a stool, you know, one of these Dickensian affairs, from the Dickensian draper shop, these high stools, on which you sat whilst operating the set. And when one was operating or listening out and the other had nothing to do, we would do 2-hour stretches, my partner and I, and the one who wasn't on duty would curl up on the iron deck, using an old life belt as a pillow on top of the charging batteries, and curl himself around the stool because the thing wasn't, the cabin wasn't long enough for you to stretch out. So you lay there, more looking like a question mark almost, you know, and had a couple of hours sleep or whatever, with all the noise that was going on and the banging and the shouting and so on, and the engine noises. It was quite difficult, but you got used to it. And we operated this in turn, he and I, until he left the ship about 2 months later, when I had to do the job on my own, and I couldn't afford to lie down for 2 hours. I had to stay awake all night and carry out my duties. We usually went on watch at sea. We went when you left the anchorage and went out through the boom. You usually went to what was known as defense stations, which means sort of a semi-readiness state. The next step after that was action stations. And you had to be reasonably alert, but nothing was expected to happen. During daytime, we didn't even have to man our sets, because we knew the E-boats wouldn't dare in broad daylight to come out because they'd have been decimated by our aircraft, if not by naval vessels. They usually left their anchorages in Denmark and Holland and Germany sort of at dusk to get into the shipping lanes near the East Coast sometime during the middle of the night, and made sure that they got back before it became light, or at least that they were well on their way back before it got light, so as to avoid attack by aircraft. So Tony initiated me into our work. We now come to the active part of my service.
Could he also speak German?
Tony, yes. Oh, yes. He did the same job as I. He was a writer special. He was Austrian-born. My first experience of warfare was not a very elevating one. We were out on patrol somewhere between Hull and coming down the lanes, shipping lanes at night, of course, when radar made a contact. We were searching, but we had nothing. And radar made a contact. So the action station signal went out. Everybody went to action stations. We sat there, you know, all ready. I happened to be at the time operating the set, and Tony was operating the communication with the bridge should it arise. When all of a sudden there was a most almighty explosion, and the ship went vroom, over, heeled over to port, which was our side, and then straightened out again. It caught me completely unawares. And I said, "What's that, Tony?" He said, "We've just fired our 4-inch guns." So I carried on, and I suddenly realised that an urgent change of underwear was needed. I had involuntarily opened my bowels, and I couldn't do that once we were in action. So once we went back to the defence station, the first thing I ever had was shower, clean myself and my clothing up. And so it wasn't all that bad, but I mean, I had literally, involuntarily shit myself without realising it at the time. It only took me a little later, I realised there was something not quite as it should be. It never happened again. I was never caught unawares like that. Again, it was the first time I saw action, literally. We didn't have any success either. I did, whilst Tony was still aboard, we did have a success. We were protecting a convoy, and our skipper, Lieutenant Cole, RN, being the junior officer of the escorting two destroyers and a number of smaller escort vessels, we were the rear escort of a convoy of ships going along the East Coast. And I was searching the wavelength when suddenly I got a carrier wave, a beep, and I flicked the switch just in time to hear a German voice saying, "Tony Dora, to destroyer to starboard, fire torpedoes at destroyer to starboard." At the same time, radar announced they got a contact to port. So I reported up to, or my partner reported up to the bridge, "German's been ordered to fire torpedoes to destroyer to starboard." And we immediately did a sharp turn to port in the direction of the Germans, firing various guns, such as they were. And the lookouts on the sides of the bridge reported this fluorescence in the water from passing torpedoes. So they didn't hit us, they went past us. By that time we were going this way and the torpedoes that. And we were firing at these things, and the skipper occasionally, somebody sort of said, "Oh, I think we've got one," or something like that. And so on. Anyway, when the patrol was over, we went back to Sheerness. The skipper announced that he claimed to have sunk one E-boat and damaged and possibly sunk a second one. This went through to Admiralty, of course. Admiralty verified the one sinking. They couldn't verify the rest of it. They issued the ship with a few medals, about 4 or 5 medals. There was one for officers, DSC, a Distinguished Service Cross. And that went to the first lieutenant, who was at the time actually running the thing. And there was one DSM, one Distinguished Service Medal, and that was allocated, I think, to the coxswain, to one of our senior chief petty officers anyway. Either the coxswain or the gunner's mate, I think, may have been the one that got it, since they sank it. And there were 3 mentions in dispatches, and the captain announced that these would be balloted for, you know, raffled away, you know, I mean, drawn for. And 3 assorted people got a mention in dispatches, because the skipper said, "I can't pick out anybody who did better than anybody else, because you all did fantastically well. And it would be unfair to single out any one person for an award." So this was the way they did it, whatever people may say today. And that's the way, the only time that I ever had occasion to take part in a thing like that, or be part of this. We had an officer ashore, and that was this Lieutenant Chambers I mentioned earlier. He was our shore-based officer, and we were supposed to report to him every forenoon before 11 o'clock, I think, between 10 and 12, something like that, all from all the various ships, with our logbooks showing exactly what we'd seen, heard and done. And there I came across a young chappie. He was the most unlucky guy I've ever met. He was brand new, He was allocated to one of the ships in our flotilla. I regret I can't remember the name of her. The first night on board ship when they didn't know the stem from the stern, they had a 2-hour action with E-boats. And he came back traumatized the next morning, no shaky. He didn't even know the names of his shipmates. Then they had another set to with some German craft, and 2 days later or so, and it was quite a terrible sort of traumatic start. It hadn't been on board ship a week yet, and twice it'd been in action. Again, 1 or 2 days later, his ship was out of patrol, and he was going to go on duty, and he was just finishing off a letter to his parents. He was sitting in the mess, and had a nice fountain pen, and he was writing to Mum and Dad, when suddenly the lights went out, the pen disappeared from his hand, and the ship sort of was tilting in a funny way. So he went scrabbling about on the deck, there's nobody else about, looking for this confounded pen, when suddenly somebody grabbed him by the scruff of the neck and said, "Get up on deck, we've hit a mine, we're split in half, we're sinking." And the poor guy had to get up, a ladder that was by that time like this, get on deck, jump into the water, or into a boat or whatever, I think it was the water or on a raft, and the ship literally turned turtle in 2 sections, and they sat on the upturned keel, most of them, waiting to be rescued for an hour or two. When he came the next time to the briefing, he was so traumatized. I mean, it was unbelievable. He was only a young lad. We never saw him again. I mean, he was sent on survivor's leave. And I'm sure they gave him a sure job after that. At least I hope so. These meetings used to be sort of quite informal. You talked to the officers and the others and exchanged experiences and so on. I spent most of my free time when ashore. I loved dancing, used to go dancing there. I have to confess I never had a girlfriend in Sheerness. There wasn't anybody there young and good looking enough to interest me, to be honest. But I had my share of beers. Oh yes, there was one young lady. She was actually the daughter of a police sergeant working on the dockyard gates. And I'd been dancing with her, and she invited me home. We sat in the front room, in the dark, of course. And I had my shoes off, my boots off, I should say. We were snogging on the couch or something like that. When suddenly her father's voice is heard from upstairs, calling her name, saying, "What are you up to down there?" sort of thing. And she said, "Oh, you better scalp her, you know." But it was ground floor, window, so I dived out of the window, forgetting my boots. And the sergeant just came in as I was disappearing, and all he saw was my feet. So he grabbed hold of the boots and threw them after me, thank God. Which enabled me to make my escape and report back on board fully dressed. But he didn't recognize me, I'm pleased to say, so no harm was done. Now, where else? Yes, I mentioned that the communications by VHF are over very short distances at sea level. There were freak occasions when you picked up something, sometimes for reasons I can't explain to you, where on one occasion I was, you know, searching. Suddenly I hit a carrier wave and I press the button and I hear one half of a conversation on the telephone. And this man was obviously an American airman and he was making arrangements for a dirty weekend with a girlfriend in London. Unfortunately, I couldn't hear her, I only heard him. But he must have been many miles away, and how that got into the airwaves, I don't know. On another occasion, I came across a symphony concert, full orchestra, Sir Thomas Beecham or somebody like that conducting. And I was naughty, I listened for about 10 minutes because I should have been searching. It was fascinating. There were two more such freak receptions, as they were called. On one occasion, we were confined to Grimsby Harbour because there was a forced 10 gale and we were not going on patrol in that, looking for e-boats, which wouldn't even dare go out in a force 8. So I was sitting in my workstation, idly playing with the radio, searching, when I suddenly get a beep, the carrier wave. So I flick the switch, and I hear two chaps talking in plain German. We're not going out tonight, you know, he said, not in this weather, he said, the Englishmen will all be in harbour anyway. So we're not going out tonight, we can have a nice night out, what about it? And so there were two boats talking to each other, presumably the skippers. Let's go out on the town and so on, paint the town red. Well, I reported that to the duty officer and I said, I think Admiralty should be informed about this, perhaps. And it was done. On another occasion, I was also idly during the day flicking around. One did, you got sort of into the habit of doing this, flicking around on the set looking for things, and again I hear a beep and a switch over, and the first thing I heard was in German, Achtung Spitfeuer! That was obviously a pilot, and being high up I would hear a transmission for perhaps 100 miles. And he was obviously talking to fellow members of his squadron. Achtung Spitfire, he's seen Spitfires. And I listened on, then a loud sort of a yell. Assholes, I've been hit! And that was the end of it. There was a crackle and that was the end of the transmission. So presumably one of the Spitfires got it. But it was amazing to sort of listen into this. I mean, I was a witness to his presumed death. Because you're not likely to survive if you get shot down with Spitfire, wherever it is. And the panic in his voice, I can still sort of hear it today. Apart from that, we had a few other occasional contacts with the Germans. We were in, I can't remember if it was Ramsgate or Margate. A convoy was being assembled. This was long after the invasion, and this convoy was to go across to the European continent. And we were lying there, and we were junior escort, so we were following the last of the merchant vessels out. And the last one of them was a tanker. We weren't due to sail until midnight, so everything was quiet and so on. And on stroke of midnight, engines were switched on, sort of thing. And as this happened, there was a dull explosion from the direction of the tanker, which was 300, 400 yards away from us. And we could see that the thing was settling in the water. Obviously, something had gone wrong there. And we saw people coming on board and overboard on life raft and boats and so on. And one of the boats stopped after a short while, and it was, I can't remember why, but we could see what was going on. We saw a fellow dive back in the water and swim back like mad to the ship. Maybe we weren't as far as I thought. And he picked up a bundle lying on the deck, jumped back in the water and came swimming back laboriously to his boat. And we were to take the survivors aboard. And all these grafts and things pulled up, there were about 30 people involved, of whom the vast majority were Chinese, with not a word of English between them. And the officers were, if I remember rightly, Dutch. And what happened was that the chief engineer had lost both legs as a result of the explosion. They'd both been broken, or worse, I can't remember. They'd been sitting apparently on an acoustic mine, which had been sneaked into the harbour at some time. And when they switched on the engine, it blew up and broke the ship's back, but didn't catch fire. It just settled. And they brought him aboard, and our doctor, we had a doctor on board, and the doctor looked after him, but he was too far gone. He didn't survive the night. The seamen were distributed amongst the various messes, and we had three or four of these Chinese guys in our mess. Between them, spoke about six words of English, didn't know how to eat with a knife and fork, and weren't used to the sort of food that we had. But they soon learned, believe me, because we couldn't drop them ashore. The convoy was underway. We had to keep going. We were going to be away for 2 or 3 days. And these guys, they mucked in very, very well. And then one day, on the second day, we buried the chief engineer at sea with the usual business of a tilting plank sort of thing, weighted canvas bag and the usual prayers, and everybody was in attendance that could be. And it was very solemn and pretty quick and so on. Anyway, one of these Chinese guys came into our mess with a ball about the size of this bowl of flowers, a complete ball made of rope, and indicated to our Killick, Ginger, find the end of it. And our Ginger was a seaman, a leading seaman's barge. He couldn't find the end of this. He couldn't unravel this ball. It was complete tight. The Chinese did that sort of thing. He wouldn't tell anybody how he did it. Never got that ball unraveled. It was an amazing thing to see. Anyway, they were very well looked after on board, and we were very pleased that they were rescued and so on. We had a few more interesting experiences. On one occasion, when we were... On one occasion, His Majesty the King decided to visit the troops in France. By that time, Dieppe had been liberated. And they wanted to land him at Dieppe. Our flotilla leader, HMS Garth, was to take His Majesty on board, and HMS Holderness was to act as escort. He could not have picked a fouler day than that. The gale was force 9, force 8, force 10, the whole time out, the whole time back. And we had to go at top speed, which in our case was 28 knots with about nearly a foot of oil on the engine room deck. But we got to Dieppe, where he disembarked, and the Garth and we had to sort of patrol the sea, because at the time there was a lot of talk about German mini-subs and explosive torpedoes and stuff like that. So we were on duty the whole ruddy time. And then in the sort of late afternoon, or in the afternoon, His Majesty came back aboard the Garth, and we made hell for leather back to Dover, again in these atrocious conditions. Once we'd made fast in Dover, the King sent the signal, spliced the main brace, and praised us for excellent seamanship, blah, blah, and so on. And the skipper decided, our skipper decided, well, some of us could go ashore after a heavy day if we were still in a fit state to do anything. And I went ashore with a couple of fellows on a pub crawl. The first pub was no good because there were no girls there. The second pub was rather better, and it was funny. My shipmates decided to play a bit of a trick to attract these girls, and implied that I was connected with royalty. You see, it was known that Mountbatten was originally Battenberg. Gartenberg, Battenberg, that sounds a bit similar. And they said, well, you know, you've heard of Prince Battenberg, Gartenberg. Oh, a relative. Of course, I had to play with his third cousin or something like that. And of course, the girls all flopped around. We were all right, all four of us. So we were drinking and joking with these girls, and eventually they had to go home. Are you